I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie supported the Common Core state standards in 2013, and his state was one of the first to adopt them. Christie declared recently that Common Core wasn't working and New Jersey was going to develop its own standards, quote, not from 200 miles away on the banks of the Potomac River. He's one of a growing list of elected officials and presidential candidates who have made criticizing Common Core part of their campaigns. Some parents have also turned against Common Core, as have some teachers. So how did Common Core that was initiated by the states become associated with the federal government? And why does it have so many critics after 45 states adopted it when it was first launched? Joining us is Fawn Johnson. She's a correspondent for National Journal, and she's been covering domestic policy issues, including this one. And Fawn Johnson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
So let's go back to the beginning, and I guess how far back do we have to go to get to the beginning of Common Core?
Probably about 10 years, or maybe even sooner than that, or maybe even the way that you go back with Common Core is you think about when No Child Left Behind passed in 2001. That was Jeb Bush's brother, George W. Bush's signature education law, which set minimum standards that all children need to meet. And it was thought to be a benchmark because the idea was you wanted to make sure that kids had, you know, all kids were supposed to have basic, being able to read by third grade, for example. And immediately after that, it became clear that some of the states were tinkering around with the standards. There was a lot of wiggle room there. And so a bunch of governors came together with some education experts and tried to come up with a more nuanced set of standards, and it took them quite a while to pull it together. And then people started adopting them. So this was a long time in the making, and then the states that started adopting them were right around the beginning of the Obama administration.
And when, as you talk about nuance, as I understand it, it was to make sure that high school graduates have the kinds of skills to prepare them for college or for a career, that it was more than just basic standards. It was really standards that can help launch someone into adulthood.
Right. And the best way that to understand Common Core, there's a lot to look at there, and there's a lot of, they're very dense. But the idea is to have a set of tiered standards so that when you're in the fourth grade, for example, you can accomplish a certain number of tasks in math. That by the time you get to fifth grade, you build on those, and so on, such that when you graduate from high school, the idea is that you'll have, a more complex array of skills that in theory could take you right into college or right into a career. Keep in mind that, especially for the more disadvantaged students if they can go on to college, they go to community college. Some 70% of them have to have remediation classes just to get them to a college level stage. So it's the goal is nobody disagrees with the goal. It's just the standards themselves are complicated. The way they were put together is complicated, and then various states have gone through adopting them over the course of the years and trying to implement them. It's difficult, and there's been various bumps along the road. So even without the political brouhaha, there's a lot of things to work through on this.
And even going back to the Common Core standards, as I understand it, it was to try to get away from those bubble tests or even the kind of rote learning that we associate with those bubble tests, and to focus things like critical thinking.
Right. Can imagine how do you measure critical thinking?
I don't know. Right? I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. It is a lot more expensive than a bubble test, and that is one of the problems that has come out over the course as you've seen states adopt Common Core. So they adopted the standards and they set curriculum to meet the standards, and then in the last couple of years, there are several states who are far enough along that now they need to start testing. So there's a number of options that they can pull from. There's a couple of companies that have put together tests that are supposed to test on this. But they're expensive. And so some states that don't have a lot of money will, opt for either cheaper tests or then they've got this hybrid where so they need to have some Common Core tests, but then they need to still have their own state tests. And it it becomes this big mishmash of testing that nobody quite understands. Mm. So it's understandable that, you know, teachers are getting frustrated, that parents are getting frustrated. But again, part of the problem is that to test for something like critical thinking or being able to evaluate a complex paragraph that's nonfiction, for example, is a lot harder than filling in those bubble tests, which is what kids were doing before.
Is there any way to know, perhaps it's too soon to know, whether Common Core is working? I mean, my understanding is that the idea is to elevate learning and achievement and then to try to figure out how to evaluate that. Are there some findings or even results from testing to say, oh, Common Core is working or it isn't?
You know, there are some really preliminary, and you know, so preliminary that it's almost too difficult to tell, that say that some of the states that are the farthest along, I don't have the details of this completely in my head, but some are the farthest along in Common Core. The kids they're up nominally in math and reading, but I think the sample sizes are so small that it's kind of hard to know if it's working. Whether something is working is—it's almost the kind of question that if I think that people want to know whether it's working, but it's a difficult one to answer because the goal is to get people, you know, to get the schools to be adopting curriculum that aims at a certain standard that is very hard to measure, and it's always been the problem. That was the same problem with No Child Left Behind. So I think that even though we're not sure that we have evidence, you know, in terms of test scores, that it's doing well, that doesn't mean it's not doing well. It just means that the transition is difficult in trying to get, for example, schools to shift their reading curriculum from more of the fiction towards some nonfiction. That can't be a bad thing, because that's most of what people read, especially when they get into college or into a career.
So is this a state-based program? Is it a program that comes from the federal government? And I ask that because when you look at some of the critics, especially people that seem to have their eye on higher office, they blame the Obama administration. They blame the federal government. They talk about this intrusion into state education. Can you explain what's going on here for me?
Well, if you're confused, there's a reason for that. People are trying to confuse you, but they were written by a bunch of governors and some education experts who have been around in the field for a long time. So in that sense, definitely state based, and the idea was that each state would adopt them individually, but that if I move from say Utah to Minneapolis, that you know, I can be assured that my kids are getting a reasonable kind of curriculum that can follow along. Where it got complicated was when the stimulus package passed in the first year of the Obama administration. They put a lot of money into a program called Race to the Top, which was a competitive grant. So states were supposed to compete for education money, and based on a number of factors. But one of those factors was whether or not they had adopted the Common Core. So now what you look at is states which are totally strapped because of budget cuts, because, you know, the whole reason for the stimulus was because the economy was tanking. They've got millions of dollars being dangled in front of them, and they're being told that in order to get that money, they need to adopt Common Core. So now it's starting to look like a federal program. And the more that the administration and the education department started pushing it, the more it looked like a federal program. So this is the problem that especially the Republicans who are running for office are having, is that they, especially someone like Chris Christie, for example, who supported them initially, it becomes harder to support when you've got a president that your party doesn't. That is also supporting them.
Which is why the critics call it Obama Core, right?
Right, exactly.
How about for parents? And I think parents are up to their eyeballs in frustration over the amount of testing going on. When you look at state tests and then the possibility of I guess, Common Core testing as well.
Right.
How does that all fit together? Or does it?
It depends. It goes district by district, but generally it's a mess. And I mean, and the thing if you talk to people who are very supportive of the Common Core and very supportive of education reform generally, that's some Republicans, but not all, and it's some Democrats, but not all. What they'll say is that the Common Core testing is really not the problem. The problem is all the other tests that have that have been established as a result of it. That's really not a Common Core issue. That came from No Child Left Behind, because if you remember, one of the things that No Child Left Behind did was it set actual punishments for not meeting certain benchmarks by a certain amount of time. So in order to make sure that you didn't fall short, you had to have a number of tests leading up to the final test. So in a state like Florida, there are some districts that have 10 or 20 tests that they go through, hundreds of tests. So that's where that's where the confusion comes from. But it can be very frustrating for both teachers and for parents who wonder what the heck their kids are doing in school all day.
So do you think Common Core has become a kind of a proxy or a kind of a fill-in for the frustration stakeholders have with public education?
Yeah, I would say so. I would also say that it's a it's interesting. I spent a little bit of time talking with a number of honest-to-God Tea Party activists who really they hate Obama, they hate Obamacare, they hate pretty much everything to do with the administration. And I was talking to them about Common Core, and a lot of their frustration, it's hard to unpack their frustration with this administration and their frustration with the school system, but they are very concerned about making sure that the school is acting in a local way, that the people who are running the schools are the ones that are making the decisions about it. And I think that that's where the real fear comes in. There's a lot of misunderstanding about Common Core. Some of it is intentional, some of it is not. It's very, if you go and look at the standards, you can find them online. Mm-hmm. It's very, they're long. It's a tome. So it's not like it's the easiest thing to understand about what exactly is a third grade reading level and what do you expect, what kind of math operations do you expect my kid to be doing. So it can be, for people who are not trusting of the system to begin with and who also see that the president has, and the education department has dangled a lot of money in front of states to get them to adopt this, it looks like he's basically trying to take over their school. So I would say that it's, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of frustration based on how the school systems are operating, and then you layer on top of that sort of a political frustration with the president, and it becomes a big mess. And it's very hard for a politician to come up with a good talking point that will cut through all of that.
Fawn, about a minute before we have to say goodbye to you. So No Child Left Behind, excuse my ignorance here, No Child Left Behind continues?
It continues, but in sort of an odd capacity, because the deadline for hitting the certain benchmarks that people were supposed to meet has come and gone. The administration now has a lot more power than it did, because it is granting waivers to the states for the ability to not be punished if they don't meet those No Child Left Behind benchmarks. And one of those, by the way, one of those is adopting the Common Core. So that's yet another lure. It's not quite the way it was, but it's still in existence because there hasn't been another law that's been passed to kind of rewrite it. Congress has been working on it. It could happen this year, possibly, but it hasn't yet.
Well, Fawn Johnson, thanks for walking us through and bringing some clarity to this Common Core controversy. Thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Happy to join you.
And she's a correspondent for National Journal, has been covering domestic policy issues. And we are talking about Common Core state standards. And there has been some controversy and I think some confusion brewing about these standards. We're going to take a very short break. And then we have two guests who've been listening in, and they're going to join us after this very short break. And we want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We are talking about the political policy and parental backlash against the Common Core state standards and, frankly, testing itself. We just said goodbye to Fawn Johnson. She's a correspondent for National Journal. And now we say hello to Andrew Rotherham. He's a co-founder and partner at Bellwether Education Partners. He's executive editor of Real Clear Education and has been also a contributing editor to U.S. News and World Report. He writes the blog EduWon. And if that weren't enough, co-publisher of Education Insider. And Andrew Rotherham, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also with us is John Supovitz, and he's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education, co-director of the Consortium for Policy Research in Education. And recently he's been conducting some social network analysis of Twitter users as they discuss Common Core and how those discussions are impacting public opinion and public policy as well. And John Supovitz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning.
I was talking to Fawn Johnson and watching you take notes, react to what she said. Is there anything you wanted to add or subtract to what she said in terms of describing Common Core?
I have the advantage of being here in the studio with you, so you can see me taking notes.
Exactly.
I thought Fawn did a remarkable job. There's a couple of things I would like to add, though. She talked about the beginning of the Common Core, but I want to take us back just a little bit further because the thing that brought us to the Common Core was an experience in the 1990s called systemic reform or standards-based reform. And the idea there was that states would develop standards, aligned assessments, build capacity, and have some flexibility for localities on how to meet the standards. And the experience that we got from that was that the quality of the standards that the states produced was pretty variable. And the tests that they produced were also, in different cases, less ambitious than we would have hoped. And so we got an experience where some states, to show high performance, had pretty low-quality tests, and we got to a situation where Mississippi had higher pass rates than Connecticut, for example. And so I think that experience led us to question whether state-driven standards and state-developed assessments was really the right way to go. And I think that that's an important antecedent to how we got to the Common Core.
Andy, how do you see how do you understand or even see the backlash to Common Core? And it is coming from, you know, a couple of different areas.
Well, so
Let me put that to Andy, okay. And then John will go back to you. Go ahead,
thanks.
Andy.
So I think, you know, what Jonathan's talking about, I would even take it back further. Fawn talked about the No Child Left Behind Act and so forth. It was really President Bush's father that sort of first put the country on this path towards national standards, along with then-Governor Clinton when he was governor of Arkansas in 1989 at sort of a landmark summit in Charlottesville that committed to this idea of having national standards. It didn't get off the ground in part because of this opposition from the right and the left, and that led to the 90s and what Jonathan was just describing. And I think what's really salient from that is this idea, and right now with this coalition reemerging, people are like, wow, isn't this interesting that the far right and the far left are coming together to fight against standards? But traditionally, that has been, if you look at education reform, really, you know, over about the last 30 years, that has been the coalition that has tended to come together to thwart it, whether it was the push for national standards, whether it was President Clinton's push for national tests, whether it was, frankly, a lot of the elements of the No Child Left Behind Act. Mm-hmm. That coalition traditionally fights these things off, and the question is always whether there's enough people in the center for these things to take hold. And that coalition has now reemerged around this issue of Common Core and the Common Core tests. And so sort of it's some new players, and we're talking about people like Chris Christie and so forth, but the politics are actually fairly longstanding education politics.
Well, John, going back to you, and I wonder whether the longer it has taken to sort of roll out Common Core, the more criticism has developed, because you've got to, I guess, develop curriculum, you've got to train educators, you've got to devise some kind of assessment program, you have to educate the public. And then, of course, we went through this, you know, horrible financial crisis, and we're in the state of Pennsylvania where, you know, millions of dollars were cut from education, and feeling, you know, can we meet these standards even if we think they're the right ones?
Well, I think that one thing that's also persistent is impatience. And so although the standards were first adopted by states around 2010, many people would argue that there still aren't curricula out there that are aligned with the standards. This is the first year that the two test consortia are testing with Common Core aligned assessments. And building the capacity inside of districts to actually re-educate teachers to instruct differently around the expectations of the standards takes time as well. And so it's really, really early in the game when you think of what it would take to actually see differences in terms of performance.
Are we talking about more rigorous standards then? I mean, as we understand it today. Are these more rigorous?
I think that they are both different, and they ask for some fundamentally different things, which I think people would argue are related to the new economic expectations for world competition. And so the standards really focus on more in English, they focus on more evidence-based argumentation, not just spitting back and regurgitating. And in math, a balance of conceptual understanding and procedural capability. And so just knowing procedures is a really brittle approach
sure.
of learning. But understanding things conceptually is much more flexible, and you can use those skills to build towards much more ambitious math.
Andy, where do you stand on Common Core?
You know, it's one of these questions in education. I mean, on what element of it? I mean, in general, I think the standards will be an improvement for what's been going on in a number of states. I think it's a sea change, though, and the idea that we've gone too fast, there may be some merit to that. And the Common Core is probably greatest strength in a decentralized system like this is that it's not a curriculum. That's also probably its greatest liability. Mm-hmm. And so your teachers are being asked to really fundamentally change what they're doing, teach at a much higher level than we have traditionally done. And the support for that, I think, across the country is wholly inadequate. And so that's creating a lot of frustration and friction. And I think that would happen even in a vacuum, and then you layer all these politics on top. So I think there's some promise in having a more common set of standards. I think it will help rationalize the education sector in some ways that traditionally have not happened. And we still, in many ways, the sector still operates. It's a $650 billion annual sector, but it still operates very much like a cottage industry. And there's real promise there, but we shouldn't expect too much from these standards, both in terms of just how daunting the implementation is. And then also, for kids to really achieve at higher levels, there's a whole bunch of other things that have to change as well in school and out of school. And those are things, you know, around school finance, teacher quality, a whole bunch of other things. And standards alone aren't going to drive those kinds of improvements without a real systemic push. And, you know, that's, again, always a challenge, and then particularly so when you get these really intense politics.
Well, and just picking up on that and thinking of the kids that are not ready for school when they start school. I mean, some kids really, you know how to read and do basic math. Some kids have never really cracked a book. That's to you, Andy.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's where, you know, the really interesting, among many interesting splits, I guess I should say, is, you know, a lot of people see this idea of, and you're hearing it sort of knowledge equality in terms like that get tossed around, where essentially kids do start out and you see these gaps, and then they actually grow larger while kids are in school. So there's this raging debate about whether or not schools are to blame, and the answer is, you know, sort of. These kids come with gaps that obviously the schools are not the fault of the schools, but then the schools don't do their job of shrinking those gaps and overall in many cases exacerbate them. Through common practices in the way we organize education. And so so we're stuck with this political debate. But what a lot of people see is this opportunity to, with a more coherent set of standards, a more rigorous curriculum, start to shrink that gap and start to have this sort of equality of knowledge and say, yeah, kids are coming from houses where there's books everywhere to houses where there's really no printed material. And that what we can do is start to level that and give kids a foundational experience. It's a real springboard that's easier to say than it is to do substantively. And again, you get into these politics around when you say a coherent curriculum. The next question is obviously, well, whose curriculum?
Sure.
And then, you know, enormous battles break out.
Indeed. And I do want to pick up on that. John, let me go to you and to some of the research that you've been doing, which is looking at social media, specifically even the role of Twitter in this whole debate and discussion about education, testing, Common Core. What did you find?
Well, one of the interesting things is that when the last major go-around with reform, No Child Left Behind, occurred, Twitter didn't exist. Google was getting started. And so social media really hadn't taken off. And so I think that this is the first major education reform that's played out in a environment of social media. And so what we did is we examined 190,000 tweets from 53,000 distinct actors and looked at the conversations that they were having around the Common Core. We did this during a really interesting time, and this was the time when support for the Common Core in the polls was declining and becoming more partisan. And what we found was that, by and large, the social networks around the Common Core were really focusing on other issues aside from the standards. So the politicization that Andy was talking about was really rampant on Twitter. And
so Common Core became kind of a stand-in for other complaints about education?
Yeah, we called it a proxy war. The standards really aren't the issue that people are discussing when we look at hashtag Common Core. What they're discussing are things like the federal role in education, as you mentioned, data privacy and access to children's data through standards in education, the proliferation of testing, of course, the privatization of public education, and whether or not standards are the right way to go about increasing equity in society. And so these were really the issues. Standards almost didn't come up at all except for two areas. And one was early childhood education, whether they're developmentally appropriate. And the other is whether standards are really focusing too much on academic skills and not enough on social and emotional skills.
I mean, those seem like pretty high-level discussions. If people may or may not understand what Common Core is, but they are taught these are critical issues to education.
Yeah, the folks who are debating on Twitter are what I call the activist public, and these are very, very motivated, very knowledgeable people. But interestingly enough, they're not from organized advocacy groups. They're just citizens who are really, really care and are interested in public debates around education.
And that's a good thing, isn't that?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's John Supovitz. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education, co-director of the Consortium for Policy Research in Education, and as he just explained, has been doing some interesting research on social network analysis of Twitter users as they discuss Common Core. Also with us is Andrew Rotherham, and he's co-founder and partner at Bellwether Education Partners, also editor of Real Clear Education. And we are talking about the fact that Common Core has come to mean a number of things, some of them correct, some of them not, and also about the protest about testing and what is going on in schools. We realize that schools are closed, which means that we can hear from parents and perhaps teachers and from students as well. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. And I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Andy, what do you make of this, the parents doing the opting out of testing?
Yeah, this is a really interesting phenomenon that's breaking out, and I think it's sort of too early to tell where exactly it's going. And it's happening for different reasons. I think what it points up is in this country, there's really two kinds of tests now, and this is part of what's complicating the implementation for the Common Core. And essentially, there's rich kid tests and poor kid tests. And the rich kid tests are tests like the SAT, the ACT, College Board Achievement tests, the IB test, the National Baccalaureate, things like that. No one is opting out of those. Everybody, in fact, affluent parents are paying a fair amount of money for out-of-school supports to make sure their kids do well on those tests. And they're opting into those by the millions. Then you've got what you can call these poor kid tests, which are the tests that that all kids have to take in school. And particularly at the high school level, you're seeing a lot of parents say, I don't want my kid to take that test because, I live in New Jersey. Why do I want to take the PARC test? Because that has nothing to do with whether my kid gets into college. I want them to focus on the SAT because that's the test that's going to go a long way towards determining which college they go to. And so you're seeing sort of a lot of angst about this, which is not unreasonable. You can see why a parent would say that. Why do I want my kid doing this? Then at the other grades, you have a lot of concern that's manifesting itself. You know, the crazy thing about these tests is because of the lack of transparency, most people have never actually seen them. They may have seen a handful of released items. There's a lot of stuff floating around the Internet that's not even real and not even actual items. Hmm. And so people are sort of, they're reacting as a lot of fear and so forth. And as a parent, I can appreciate that. If your school is telling you your kid has to do this thing that you don't want them to do or that you don't understand, you're naturally going to resist. What we're seeing is disproportionately the opt-outs are happening in more affluent communities, not exclusively, and so the opt-out proponents can point to outlier examples. But overall, it seems to be happening more in affluent communities. It seems to be happening more in places where it's been organized, and where there's some sort of organizing going on with different kinds of groups and organizations and so forth. And it's happening this year because it's rolling out. I think the real interesting test will be, no pun intended, the real interesting test will be next year to see how this goes. And I think partly how officials respond. I think if people want to opt out, officials should just let them opt out. And then sort of turning this into a big fight is probably sure to inflame it. I'm not sure how productive it is. But if it turns into sort of a big thing, it'll become a focus point for resistance. I think if officials just say, if you don't want to have your kids take these tests, you can opt them out. I think this anger tends to dissipate in American politics, and this will dissipate over time.
John, I'm looking at actually an article about a local woman here. She's objecting to her three public school children who are taking the Pennsylvania System of School Assessment, or the PSSA. Her complaint is that they're spending something like 12 hours over a time period, but nonetheless 12 hours during the school day taking the tests. And she's saying that's just too much time testing.
So I think that this sort of represents a good example of the phenomenon. I just want to add to what Andy was saying that it's almost ironic that at this time we are so there's all this backlash against testing because the testing is really a byproduct of the previous era, the No Child Left Behind era. And in that period, when George Bush was president, we had a proliferation of high stakes tests. It was a period of test based accountability, and that was the way that we felt like we were going to improve the education system. The Common Core really has replaced that movement as more of an emphasis on the standards or expectations as opposed to the tests as the prod for improved performance. But as a consequence of No Child Left Behind, this testing apparatus was built up, and it's sort of increased in volume over time, and it's that volume that now people are reacting to, even though they're reacting to a phenomenon that was in the previous era of reform.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about the Common Core state standards, also talking about the amount and kinds of testing that's going on in schools. And again, I should say, our guests are Andrew Rotherham and John Supovitz. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Looks like a lot of people want to join it. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about the Common Core school or academic testing and some of the backlash against this testing. And again, our guests are John Supovitz and Andrew Rotherham. We do have a lot of people that want to join us. A quick question to you, Andy. This is based on some of the reading that I did of some of your reporting, which is some states that have, I guess, rebranded Common Core or use something besides Common Core to describe the kind of standards, I guess, and testing we've been talking about, have had a very different response to what is, in a sense, Common Core. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, in pretty much every state, you have some low-level amount of noise about the standards, and that's just been ongoing since the 90s. States adopted these standards. But, you know, you don't have these sort of spikes that you've seen in states like, you know, for example, the debate in New Jersey or the recent debate in Indiana. And there are some states, so for example, Alaska's standards are very Common Core aligned, and there just hasn't been, you know, there hasn't been anything above that sort of normal level of noise that you hear about these things. Virginia, the math that kids are bringing home is basically Common Core math, but it's not called that, so you're not hearing sort of this backlash. And then in states that have you know, quote-unquote, opted out of the standards, for example, Indiana, the standards they've then adopted are basically identical to Common Core, but it's diffused the situation because it's not called Common Core. And I think that gets at, you know, what Jonathan earlier called the proxy, and in one of my columns for U.S. News recently, I was talking about how, you know, people, essentially these issues, people are arguing about other things. It's about federalism. It's about control. It's about whether or not they like testing. you rarely hear specifics. I get a lot of correspondence from parents about this, about things they're concerned about, letters home that the schools are sending or various policies. But I never get, like, no one ever says, you know, I don't think in third grade kids should be, like, decoding multi-syllable words or, you know, that they should be, you know, able to understand the Latin roots of words. I don't think that's a good standard. It's never about that stuff. It's about these larger issues. And this is, you know, this is very much sort of a proxy war.
Well, we have a parent joining us. This is Susan from Hockessin, Delaware. Susan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I live in northern Delaware. I have two kids in the public school system, soon to be three, and they just finished fifth and second grade. So we've done some of this testing and the Common Core. And I had a question about this stress and anxiety that the students are supposedly feeling about taking these tests. Because we've been told that no matter what they score on these tests, it doesn't affect their classroom grade, and it doesn't affect their promotion to the next grade. So from my perspective, my kids pretty much have no skin in the game. The tests are hugely important for the teachers, though. And my concern is that the teachers are communicating their own stress and anxiety and what's on the line for them to the students rather than insulating them from that pressure. And I do see, and I know it's a commercial and there's definitely an axe to grind, but I do see the commercials coming out of, you know, sometimes New Jersey and with the education groups that are very anti-testing, and they keep coming back to the stress of the students. And from my perspective, that's being communicated to them because my fifth grader came home with opinions about the tests that I could tell were directly from his teacher. Like his teacher was sort of editorializing his own feelings about giving the test and what was on the test. And my son came home and had opinions about tests that I know were not his before he left for school. And I just wondered if you're getting
sure.
comment on that.
No, Susan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. John, we're going to toss that to you.
Well,
I would love to
hold on.
Andy,
hold on. But let me give John a chance and then we'll go to you. I promise.
I was just going to say that Susan, there's really a Russian doll effect going on here because the kids are getting it from the teachers are getting it from the administrators are getting it from the state policymakers, and the state policymakers are getting it from the state politicians. So, you know, there's this chain of consternation and hand-wringing that's coming down to the kids, and I think that part of that is due to the political climate that we're all operating in. But I also want to say that this is a long-noted thing that the target of the object here is to have kids perform better, and we're testing kids, but the units of accountability are not the kids so much. They're the teachers and they're the system. And so this motivational mismatch is has long been noted, and I think that this is a hard one to solve. And I think it really comes down to pedagogical approaches that really excite kids and motivate kids about learning so that kids are engaged in and take ownership of their own learning and their own performance.
And do you want to weigh in on that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think Jonathan's right on kids need to be engaged and they need to feel like they're stakeholders. And I think high-stakes tests for kids, actually, those are policies that I don't generally favor. High stakes for adults who serve kids is really important to a highly effective system. And I think what the caller is saying, I wrote a column on this a couple of weeks ago, you know, this drives me bonkers. It drove me bonkers about my kids' school, where you have this situation where, you know, testing time comes and they're having pep rallies and everybody's wearing the same color T-shirt. And then the teachers and the administrators look at you, especially the administrators, and are like, we don't know why the kids are stressed out. And you look at them and you're like, well, it's probably because they're all wearing the same color shirt, you know, and you're making a big deal about this. And I feel like what Jonathan said about this sort of Russian doll example, that's fine. But what we frankly need is some people to stand up and say, grown-ups, don't behave like this. And you cannot like some of the policies. I don't like some of the policies. But this is adults don't project stress onto kids. It's not professional. And some of the frustration and anxiety about the test needs to be projected back onto the schools and say, why are you treating it like this? Why are you behaving like this? Because there are plenty of schools in this country to get fine results on these tests and where it's not a three-ring circus, and parents should simply expect more. I mean, I think the caller on the phone, her sense of frustration, I think a lot of people are feeling, and we need to have a conversation about that, and we need to not pass the buck and say, well, if the policies, it's this. This is just not something that adults should be doing. It's not professional.
Susan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I see an email comment here, and I'll toss this to you, John. Do you think it's right and fair to base teacher evaluations on whether it's Common Core testing or some of this other, as we call it, high stakes testing? Does that seem like the right approach?
So there's two things, and I think that this is a really important point. I'm glad this emailer brought up this issue, because coincident with the rollout of a new set of standards is this movement down the system to teacher evaluation. We used to have school evaluation basing school accountability on test performance, and now we've moved down to individual teacher accountability based on test performance. That's coincident with teachers trying to implement a new standard system with new curricula, with more ambitious expectations and all of that. And I think that speaking about stress on teachers, I think that's a huge factor. It's really interesting to note that states that have separated those issues, like California, are having a much easier time with standards implementation than states like New York, which are really pressing on that issue. And so I think that's a really important thing. So do I think it's fair? Certainly not at this time. The other huge problem with including tests and teacher accountability is that we don't test in all the subjects that teachers teach. And the last thing I think we want to do is to make testing ubiquitous and frequent in every subject at every grade. So I think that this is not a good plan.
Well, and we have done, and we probably will continue to do whole hours on that particular piece of this conversation. We have a lot of callers, including looks like Keith from Newtown, PA. Go ahead, Keith. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I live in Newtown at a well-regarded school district, Council Rock, and when my son started in the high school, I've had particular concerns about the prevalence of rote memorization, which I understand from the first caller and from some of my reading, you know, Common Core was meant to bring the standards up, essentially, so right, that we were not doing so much rote memorization. And yet, when I was talking with this person, this faculty person, the standardized testings were used to justify the need to keep doing all this rote memorization. So it's just, you know, it's somehow not getting through, I think, to key people in even well-funded and well-regarded districts.
Well, let me take your question, and Andy, I'll toss that back to you, which is, I mean, this takes it back into the classroom, and obviously teachers under a lot of pressure to not just teach, but also to make sure that at least their kids are going to score in some positive way on some of these testing here. Have teachers, you think, made that shift from teaching in a more rote kind of way to a more intellectually based kind of way, critical thinking skills kind of way?
You know, good teachers haven't taught in a rote kind of way for a very long time. And memorization and these things, they don't actually get really good results on these tests. And it generally is what happens when there's really not good teaching going on, and so parents should be concerned. And I think the caller points up, just because you live in a place with high property taxes and good home values and avowedly good schools doesn't mean there's great teaching and learning going on in every school or in every classroom, and parents have to scratch deeper than some of these superficial cues. And that's one of the awkward realities that the earlier standardized tests and now the Common Core is laying bare, is that a lot of schools aren't as good as we think they are. You know, but most of these tests, they're not asking about the memorization, and you don't need to do that. It's a set of conceptual skills, particularly in English and language arts. It's the ability to read passages of text that are not familiar to a student in the specifics, but are familiar in general, and to make sense of them and so forth. And in math, it's the ability to do sort of numeracy that I think most people would want their kids to do. And you can get there through good teaching. It goes to what I said earlier, though. This is an enormous shift. And there's a lot of aspects of the system including the readiness of the teaching force to meet them, that are big open questions. And I think arguably the support is not there yet to meet these challenges. And so you're going to have these friction points emerge, like the friction point that the caller is concerned about. And then the other piece of this, obviously, is this is a decentralized school system. You know, we have 100,000 schools spread out across 12,000 some odd school districts, and so implementation is always going to be uneven, and it's going to be that's just the nature of when you have when you have states making these decisions across 50 states and then across all these school districts. There's always going to be unevenness. There's always going to be people who are frustrated by the way things are happening in their particular community.
Well, John, I wonder what the Twitterverse response was when U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan said that white suburban moms, that's a quote here, were resisting the implementation of Common Core because, and I'm quoting again, all of a sudden their child isn't as brilliant as they thought they were and their school isn't quite as good as they thought they were. I mean, what was the Twitter response to that?
Actually, the Twitterverse blew up over that issue, and that turned out to be the most prolific day of the 6 months that we examined. Surprise, surprise. And I think that this points to a couple of really important things. One is that this standards movement is really reaching beyond the traditional low-performing schools that reform usually targets and really trying to influence the broader system. And so by bringing out a notion of the middle class, it really, really focused on that being part of the target of this reform. I also want to bring back to the previous caller and point out that one of the really powerful things about standards is the way that it catalyzes all kinds of educational issues. So I called it a proxy war before, but it's also a catalyst for changing the teacher preparation system, for changing the college and K-12 alignment system, for changing the teacher evaluation system. So this is one of the real powers and influences of this reform is that its tentacles are really reaching out to all parts of the education system.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get, looks like Bruce from Chambersburg to join us on Radio Times. And Bruce, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
One of the questions I have, my wife and I were teachers for a number of years. We have grandchildren in the both public and private school systems. And the testing that's done is done against a recommended curriculum. My question is, what role or part does a local school system have in the development of the curriculum against which the testing is being done? A second issue.
Well, you know what, Bruce? Only because we're almost out of time here. Let's take your first one because it's a good one. And Andy, let me toss that to you. I mean, just how much, I guess, autonomy and freedom to local school districts or even local schools have?
Well, first of all, it varies place by how materials are adopted. But I mean, I would encourage people to read the Common Core standards, and they are standards reasonable people can disagree about, as they can disagree about most of the issues that we're discussing. But what you'll see is there's a variety of curricula that can be used against them. How those decisions are made, how much voice teachers have in that, it really varies state by state. Again, the system's very, very decentralized, and the way it's done in one place is not going to be the way that it's done someplace else. And as I tried to say earlier, you know, the greatest weakness of Common Core, and it's probably its greatest strength, is that it's not a curriculum. And so people have been left on their own to figure that out. And I think, you know, as we've seen with curriculum in the past, you know, wildly uneven in terms of the quality and the level of support for teachers around that.
John, I'm giving you 30 seconds and the last word. Anything you want to add?
I think that this is just a really important point, that the standards are a set of expectations, and the curricula, the day-to-day materials that teachers use to meet those expectations, is left unstated in the standards. And so the distinction between these two is crucially important.
Well, on that note, my thanks to the two of you for helping us clarify some of these issues related to Common Core. John Tupavis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education and co-director of the Consortium for Policy Research in Education, Andrew Rotherham, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Co-founder, partner at Bellwether Education Partners, also executive director of Real Clear Education. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, also how to download a podcast of the show. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.